end of the day, about which my tutor just want to say a couple of words.
Just to confirm that the program is correct in that nothing is planned for this afternoon. We're out in the talks. and nothing else is planned, I'm afraid. We've been rather lazy about that, but we hope you'll perhaps go and have a look at Cambridge in the sunshine, I hope. if it rains, you can try the Fitzwilliam Museum, which I believe is from. I went there about 40 years ago, and it seems to be quite good there. It's even older now. We could try punting, otherwise known as synchronized drowning. Or you can just absorb the wealth of material that we've had over the last 2.5 days. So we'll be ready for the test on Friday.
Okay, so the speaker is Mark Owen.
Wonderful to be here. So I'll talk today about transposably invariant. That's probably a cryptic couple words to start a title with, but by the end of the talk, it should be clear what that is. My co-author is Patrick Perry. Patrick is a PhD student at Stanford. He's worked with me on the cross-validation part of this. When I sent in the abstract, I emphasized more or less equally how to bootstrap this kind of data and how to cross-validate. But in the months that have gone on, the cross-validation part has taken on a little bit more life for me. And so I'll talk first about the cross-validation and maybe only about the cross-validation. Worked all too well. Okay, so here's what I like to call statistics as usual. So we're statisticians, we come into our office in the morning, there's data waiting for us, and there's rows and columns. So we organize our data into rows and columns. Now, it's not an accident. The rows and columns, they have meaning. Like, one of those columns is usually called Y, unless you do multivariate statistics, then two or more are called Y. But we have X and we have Y. Sometimes we just have X or Y. But the columns have names on them. The rows, maybe the rows don't have names. So we put variables at the top and cases down the side. And the variables, like one of them's a pressure, one of, you know, systolic blood pressure. The next one could be an indicator of whether the person has health insurance. Another one could be heart rate. These are all things that we're interested in. Pressure, income, volume, and they're persistently interesting. We actually care about blood pressure apart from our data set. If another data set comes along or another context comes along, blood pressure is still an interesting concept. The rows are different. Row 3 is of no intrinsic interest. I get a new data set, there's going to be a new row 3. It doesn't really mean anything to me that row 3 is the same as the first row 3. The rows are discardable. The columns have persistent interest. The columns are just these anonymous replicates. We sample IID from some distribution. We could put them in any order. We're not that interested. Actually, they're a nuisance. I don't even want them. I want the distribution F on the column names. If I had that, I wouldn't even need data. I just want the distribution in this usual statistics as usual. Now, I don't get that. When I walk in to look at my email box, nobody's mailed me the distributions to work on. They've mailed me a sample. But the rows are anonymous, the columns are meaningful and named. Okay, so that's statistics as usual. We only care about the cases because they get us to the things that we want to know about, which are the columns. Well, here's another setting, brand new setting. Actually, it's not. It's new to me a few years ago. Later, of course, you find out that something that strikes you as new is it was new to you, but it's not new to everybody. But here's a kind of data, you could call it variables by variables. So Netflix released 100 million movie ratings. And the typical thing is, well, there's movie 1, and viewer one. And viewer one kind of liked movie one, or film one, if you prefer, and gave 4 stars. However, movie one only got 1 star from viewer three. So there's a kind of data. And of course, there would be a lot of missing in there. Now, if we want to learn about viewer two, because maybe we want to make recommendations to viewer two, we can use the movies. But the movies, maybe they're not really IID rows. Actually, we want to know about the movies too. So the movies are entities that are of persistent interest to us. And if we're a company serving the viewers are of persistent interest to us too. So when this kind of data comes into your email box, actually that would be, it would burst your email box, that one, but you don't even know whether what should be the rows and what should be the columns. They both want to be the columns. So there's your data matrix. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, that's your data matrix. Tuesdays, Thursdays, you transpose it. It's still a data matrix when you transpose it. So this, these kind of problems pop up a lot. It's not just movies. So suppose you work at, you work at Amazon.com. Somebody comes in and they buy a book. Okay, which button does the big one in the middle maybe does? Ah, okay. Actually, we can. Okay, if I push there. So somebody comes in to buy books, and they come in from an IP address, 183.67.whatever, and they buy Harry Potter, and they spend this amount of money. Or they come in from this IP address, they use that credit card number, and they spend this amount of dollars. Well, we might be interested in studying the IP addresses in case we wanted to learn something about some nastiness. Actually, with the credit card numbers, there could be nastiness too. Some of those could be quite interesting. How come that credit card is getting used at 1,000 different IP addresses to buy books? Maybe we should stop honoring it. So it's entities by entities, and they're both interesting. And in information retrieval, there are terms and documents, and you study the words by what documents they're in, and you study the documents by what words are in them. So it seems also one hand washes the other. When people are rating, like suppose you were interviewing, you look at job interviews, and you've had thousands of people go for interviews and some other number of people interviewing them, then you could start to learn, you want to learn, well, of course, what's a good candidate, but you also might want to start handicapping your interviewers if you had that sort of data. And a graph, you've got nodes and nodes. And, sometimes the row entities are actually the very same as the column entities. So a lot of these things, they strike you as new, but of course this kind of data has been around a long time. So it's not quite statistics as usual. Another example that I find quite interesting, in crop science, and actually following the stuff, I ended up Googling my way into the crop science literature, where they'll have different types of plant, and then different, say, different genotypes, and then different environments, and then what was the yield. Okay, so that's also, you really care about this kind of plant or that, but you also care about this or that kind of environment. Why? Well, suppose you're trying to customize. I don't want just the universally best kind of corn. I want to customize it from one environment to another. Well, then I have to know something about both sides of the equation. Well, before I go there, this is just, rows, columns. There are many examples where there are rows and columns and then a third dimension, or a fourth, or even more. Okay, we can actually turn this. This doesn't have to be transposable. We can turn this into statistics as usual, and here's how we do it. There's a trick. We just write it as cases. So now we have anonymous cases. Case one, we say, well, what movie was it? Who was the viewer? What was the rating? We don't even bother with the missings, unless we want to. And now we're back to statistics as usual. In fact, it's not even a large p. It's a small p. P is 3. Sometimes p is just 2, because sometimes we just have it's implicit. So we're back to statistics as usual. No, we're not really back to statistics as usual. The cases are anonymous again, but we have 2 categorical variables with lots of levels. So if I'm used to categorical data where we have three kinds of iris plant. I'm not used to categorical variables where the number of levels is close to my sample size. That's different. And you know, then there's always going to be a ZIF-like behavior in that setting. So some of those things will be quite well known. Some of them, if you're looking at a query that comes into a page, that query may never reappear. But other queries, of course, are ubiquitous. Okay, so we have two categorical variables with lots of levels. But actually, we're not back to statistics as usual because these are not independent rows anymore. The first two rows, well, it was the same movie. The second and third row, no, hold on, the first and third row, it was the same person. So it's not really IID. So how should we bootstrap and cross-validate this? In the IID world, we count on the bootstrap and cross-validation so much. You make up a model, you don't really believe the model, but then you bootstrap and see how it shakes out. Or you make some ideal assumptions to get predictions, but then you cross-validate just to double check. And when you're explaining this stuff to a scientist and you do a cross-validation, they really believe it. You've held out things. You're doing on the data the exact same thing that they want to do on the real data. So there's a face value validity to the bootstrap and cross-validation. So for example, when Peter used a bootstrap to look how stable the ranks are, nobody was saying, what's the coverage level of this, you know, apparent 95 or 98 or whatever percent thing. Everybody kind of believed that's about right. Other questions were, are you getting the confidence interval for the right thing? So we believe in the bootstrap, and we believe in cross-validation, and we almost don't even have to explain it. But what about with this kind of data? Can you still bootstrap and cross-validate? Okay, well, here's like a cartoon sketch of cross-validation. We form our pairs, and we're in XY land. We leave out a few of them. We fit whatever we want to do to the retained models, assuming normality if we like, or assuming whatever, and then we predict the ones that were held out. And we can evaluate our whole package, all the assumptions, algorithms, and everything combined tell us how well the prediction works. In the bootstrap, our observations are IID from some F. We just don't know F. That was our only problem. But we get a good guess of it. Okay, F hat. F should be something like F hat. Now we can sample from F hat. And then we play the following analogy. Well, we say that data R to F as the resampled data R to F hat. So A is to B as C is to D. We know three of those, but not the fourth. And then all kinds of pivots and calibration and bootstrap confidence intervals and whatnot are based on just using this analogy. Okay, so cross-validation and bootstrap work pretty nicely in the IID case. What we like? Well, let's suppose we do this for these transposable settings. For the bootstrap, let's look at something really complicated. Like suppose you've just gotten maybe Inderjit Dhillon's very latest spectral biclustering whatever, and you don't really understand it. You don't know if you should believe it, but it looks pretty cool. And what you'd like to do is just run it a bunch of times. And on resampled data, refit it, and you know, the important things are going to stay the same every time. And then there'll be wobbly things that are just different every time. And then you don't want to trust the wobbly features, but the rock stable things you can find. And then you can sort of find the boundary between what's stable and what's wobbly, if you could bootstrap. So that's for complicated things. For simple things, you know, do those Harry Potter readers really like Mozart 3% more than everybody else likes Mozart? Because if they did, we could make an extra $600 a year for Amazon.com. And, you know, and they'd take that $600 a year, which wouldn't necessarily make a dent for Jeff Bezos. But there's 10,000 little rules like this. that you could get out of the data, more maybe. Some of them are probably right and would make you those $600 a year, and some of them might lose you. So you'd like to kind of know, of all the things in my data, which ones should I believe and which ones should I not? And just because you have, you know, billions of records, it doesn't mean that every sample fact in the data is right for the population. There's still noise, especially when you get down to the fuzzy edge of just little tiny effects. For cross-validation, we'd like to leave out some known data and predict them by filling in, filling in the gaps. Well, if I left out the row that says Harry Potter from my list of books, how do I predict from all the books that aren't Harry Potter, you know, what's going to be the numbers in the Harry Potter row? Well, I could have features of the books, but suppose I'm dealing with like an IP address and I don't have any good features for it, or somebody's phone number. If I've left out the whole row, I have no way to predict it. Okay. Also, in these settings, we really should get the same answer for X as we get for X transpose. So that's transposably invariant. Okay, so this is what we've more or less found. You can bootstrap those triples. So if I took the triples of data and just resampled from them, I could resample them, I get a bootstrap. Or we could go and we could resample the rows, then independently resample the columns. So if row one comes in twice and column one comes in three times, you have to put the one element in six times. But if you just bite down hard and do that, you resample by rows and columns independently, you get a different kind of bootstrap. With cross-validation, you can resample, you can sort of leave out a bunch of the elements, take 10% of the elements and kick them out. Or you can take a few of the rows and a few of the columns and kick out the block and then predict the missing block. So there's by elements and then there's by axes. And you can bootstrap and cross-validate. And I'll put this is something, for want of a better word, we'll just say it's wrong to do that. And Peter McCullough has this beautiful paper where he proves that in this sort of transposable setting, there is no correct bootstrap. Not just like the bootstrap, but any bootstrap. That was sort of disturbing. In an example with like the Netflix movie ratings, if you did this by triples, you could get the variance wrong by 50,000 or more. Wrong in the bad direction. Not that there's a good direction to be wrong by a factor of 50,000, but you could underestimate the variance of something by 50,000. You'd be just way too confident that the Mozart people and the Harry Potter people overlap. There might be more uncertainty in there, a lot more uncertainty than you'd think. Okay, so it's really not tenable to bootstrap that way. If you bootstrap by rows and columns, that's actually okay, probably okay. It's approximate. It's not correct. It's not exact because of what Peter proved. In cross-validation, I think you could run it by elements. That's a matter of taste. We find that sort of awkward, and we like resampling by blocks or cross-validating by blocks. So I'll talk about that. Okay. The kind of models that people like to fit to this data are of outer product form, most of them. So the data are Xij, M rows and N columns, just because alphabetical order. Usual ANOVA model, so there are very old methods for this kind of data. Actually, surprisingly, if you go back to Fisher and McKenzie, 1923, they already had a little smackerel of a singular value decomposition in their model. I was a little surprised to see that. There's manurial response of some kind of plants. Okay. Now, let's just extract this part here. This is the outer product part. That could be a model. We could say, let's just take this little outer product, something for the row, something for the column. Not that different from what people do. Or we could add up a few of those. We could just, you know, maybe there's more than one thing going on. We could add those up. So this is what I should call an outer product machine, really. We'd have an outer product machine And we've been using them in statistics for quite a while. Okay, so, well, here's notation. We have x looks like this. And we can write it as a sum of outer products of vectors. Or we could stuff all the vectors into a matrix. Or we could just say, you know, it's a matrix on the left times a matrix on the right. And all of those ways of writing it are handy. And what's interesting is you take a matrix on the left, a matrix on the right, but the intermediate dimension is k, which is tiny. So that's where you get some statistical power. And we've been using these in statistics a lot, so factor analysis, principal components. Sometimes we're very familiar with the SVD as a computing method, but sometimes it's actually used as a data analysis in its own right. There's a non-negative matrix factorization, very cool technique, and it has this form, except that the elements, instead of being real, they're non-negative. Okay, so that's quite a popular and interesting method. In the semi-discrete decomposition, the constraints are that these vectors have to have elements minus 1, 0, or plus 1. That compresses very nicely, especially the zeros, but the other ones are easy to keep too. K means clustering. You could write it this way, where the matrix L is a binary saying which cluster you're in, and the matrix R has all the vector means. So outer products are ubiquitous for this kind of data. However, how do we pick K? So if I fit an SVD to the data, the bigger K gets, the better my fit gets. Okay, so here's an example with some microarray data. This was made public by Novartis. And there's just over 12,000 genes in that data set, and 101 tissue samples, it might be, you know, 4 fetal brains, 4 lungs, 4 kidneys, a few things like that. Small number from each of these tissues. And if you look at the singular values, they decay fairly rapidly. And of course, if we're trying to predict, we would accumulate them. So if our model K has no terms, well, then we get 0 R squared. The minute we put in just the first outer product, we're explaining about 65%. And then we get a little bit more as we add more. And eventually, we get diminishing returns. How do you pick K? What you're supposed to do is pick the knee in the curve. There's problems with the knee. There's existence, and there's uniqueness. Sometimes there's two knees. Sometimes every point looks like a knee. Sometimes it doesn't really seem like there's a knee. Also, why should the knee be at the right place? So knee in the curve isn't really a good plan. Here's a classical solution. You could try doing an F test. So you fit the SVD with K terms. You add one more term. And look how the sum of squares goes down. And then in the denominator, you have to count how many parameters you've used up. That actually is not a straightforward thing to say how many parameters does my SVD use up when I add one more term. So there really isn't a good way to count the degrees of freedom. It's actually, and what's worse, it doesn't even work if you did count them. So if you wanted a test with a 5% level, in some simulations, you actually get a 66% level, not 5%. At least the later terms become way conservative. So there's some the total of all those p-values might be what you want. But but none of them are right. They start off very liberal, end up very conservative. Part of the problem is the data in that setting aren't IID. So it's pretty hard to get. This is a paper from the crop science literature. They're surveying all the ways people try to pick SVDs. Okay, so how could we cross-validate the SVD? Let's hold out one element. There's a classical method from 82 where they leave out the first row of the SVD. Now, if you've left a row out, your U vector is one element short of what you want. But your v-vector has all the elements. It has one for every column. So you leave out the first row, do an SVD, and take the v's. Then you leave out the first column and get the u's. The v's are no good if you left out a column, but the u's have the right length. And then you smush them together. What you do, you get two singular values from both of them. Well, let's be democratic and take the geometric mean. We'll vote them that way. And you reassemble them using the u you got from leaving out the column and the v you got from leaving out the row. Actually, you have to pick a sign, too. That's a complication. Okay, so that's how you can cross-validate an SVD. The problem is you still get, as k gets bigger, the fit gets better. So it turns out it doesn't quite work. It doesn't quite beat the problem. Here's this method that Gabriel published. Here's the element that we've left out, and we want to predict that one element from the other parts of the matrix. So Gabriel says, fit an SVD to this part. Okay, there we are. And then he takes the generalized inverse of that SVD, let's say like this, like that, and like that. He multiplies on the left by this guy, then he multiplies on the right by that guy, that column, and that's his x1 hat. And it seems to work. In the crop science literature, they like it. They don't get that the minimum is take the biggest possible k. When you cross-validate, you expect that the curve should come down really fast till you have everything that you should get, and then usually creep up slowly as you add extra terms that hurt you a little bit, but not as much as leaving out something. It seems to work. So we looked at, well, why does it work? Okay, so first thing we do is we generalize it, because you don't want to leave out every element in turn on a big matrix. The computation, if you had to do an SVD, if you had to do m by n SVDs, it's going to be a nuisance. So let's generalize Gabriel and leave out a block. So here's this whole block, an r by s block we'll leave out. And we'll fit an SVD to this d. And we'll use it to predict a. So we have to use b and c as well. Okay, so we fit the SVD to d. We truncate it. And then we predict by basically b, d inverse c. So we can't quite invert d. What we do is we take a Moore-Penrose inverse of its k-term SVD. Okay, so now we're doing b, d inverse c. That's a hat. And then, of course, then everybody takes their turn. So if we've chopped this up into a 5x5 block, then there's 25 little squares that all get their turn to be held out, and everybody else goes in to be the SVD on those times. And we sum up, say, the total squared error. Okay, so here is a toy example. This matrix actually has rank 1 because the second row is 3 times the first row. And if we go b, d inverse c, well, we get 2 times 6 inverse times 3, which comes out to equal 1. It works. This is why Gabriel was doing it. It works. Let's see. What if we did the row and column stuff? So if we leave out the first column, the second column has this singular value decomposition. Actually, it has plus or minus that because the sign is not determined. And if we leave out the first row, the second row has this SVD, or plus or minus. And then if we take the geometric mean and multiply out these things, we actually get back our matrix times a factor that isn't 1. It's not even plus or minus 1. Oh. So that's one hint that the leaving out a row and then leaving out a column thing isn't working. Even if I gave you a rank 1 matrix with no error, it wouldn't predict with 0 residuals. So that doesn't seem right. Gabriel's method, if I give you a rank 1 matrix, it'll predict a residual of 0. Okay. So here's our explanation of why it works. Well, suppose that this matrix really did have rank k. and that this submatrix D also has rank K. It's no fair if D doesn't have rank K too. Then A actually equals BD inverse C. In fact, if D equals its own rank K approximation, so we can write it this way too. And so that's the thing we actually use. Okay, so that's why we can consider this. This is a residual from being rank K. Okay, hold on. There we go. So here's the proof. We break the matrix up into pieces. We do little SVDlets. Decompose the SVD. Now, if this looks like a singular value decomposition, but actually it isn't. This little piece here, it's not the SVD of D. If it would be the SVD of D, we could plug that in and everything would cancel away easily. But it's not the SVD of D because U and V aren't orthogonal matrices. They're pieces of orthogonal matrices. So you have to reorthogonalize. But the generalized inverse of D turns out to have a tractable expression like that. And if you plug that in here with B on the left and C on the right, and then like Tetris blinking, this V transpose V cancels that V transpose V inverse, and everything cancels right down to A. Except if D had low rank. So if D didn't have full rank, then it's not going to work. Like, if I gave you this matrix, it's actually rank 1. But if I fit an SVD down here and try to predict the 1 up there, I'll keep predicting a 0. So I'll never get this one right. It failed the rank condition. Actually, wouldn't feel too good about predicting a 1 there from the rest of the matrix anyway. I wouldn't feel that was right. So this is a degenerate, but I think it's the right kind of degenerate. Likewise, in this case, you'll predict a 0. And here you had a clue because the rest of that whole row was 1. So maybe you should have known it was a 1, except here, of course, the column was all 0. So maybe you should have also known it was a 0. Anyway, it will predict a 0 there, not a 1. And likewise, this matrix has rank 2, and it won't predict a 1 up there. Okay, but those are degenerate things. Okay, if your feature has fewer rows and columns than you hold out, you might lose it. If you hold out the whole cluster, you can't find it. So that's not too bad. That's actually kind of robustness. If the feature was really noise, you don't want to start guessing the noise. Let's see. If you really wanted to know, if you really wanted to fix that, you could actually multiply your x on left and right by random orthogonal matrices and smear that spike across every element of the matrix. And you don't change the singular values of x when you do that. So conceivably, you could run this kind of a thing if you wanted to detect that there was a spike. I think I'd rather ignore a spike for robustness. Okay. Why is this not? Maybe need the right hand. There we go. Okay, so here it is on Novartis. The naive singular values decay like that. If we cross-validate, it comes down, flattens out. The min is about here. That's sort of disappointing. I really wanted it to come down fast and then climb up slow and give me a sparse number like 10. Then I could say there's only 10 things to know about these genes. But I think really there's more than 100 things to know about those genes. And I think by inspecting the singular vectors, they have huge kurtosis and they're pulling out little things. So I think really it is actually just steadily decreasing returns. So if you're going to chop it somewhere, it's because you prefer a sparse representation, not because it fits better. Okay. We have an alternative way to get the residual. If A is BD plus C, you could actually round B down to its rank K, or C down to its rank K, and define the residual this way too. So referee kind of pushed us to do that. And I won't say much about it. Actually, it's a neat idea, but it doesn't seem to work in the times we tried it. Okay. Let's try to get some theory for this. So in theory, let's see, the theory we started to build on, well, of course, we go to Muirhead's book to get some basics. Then we go to Johnstone to get some facts on the spiked covariance models. And then ultimately, we ended up with using some recent work by Alexei Onatsky, quite powerful results from econometrics. So let's suppose that our matrix X is rank 1 plus noise. And actually, we'll say it's 0 or 1, because if this kappa is 0, it's rank 0 plus noise. If kappa is 1, if positive, it's rank 1 plus noise. And these are unit vectors. And the noise, we'll use Gaussian noise, because that's where we get the most results to build on. And the usual limits, the matrix is going to infinity, but the aspect ratio is hitting a constant. Okay. And so the true rank is 0 or 1, and we're going to try using 0 or 1. And what's the chance that we get the right answer? Okay. Well, if the true rank is 0, then the matrix is just noise. And if you knew that it was noise, and it was noise, then your d hat is 0, and the expected squared norm of your prediction is just r times s, because there's r times s of these Gaussians. However, if you fit a rank 1 when there wasn't even rank 1, you're going to get a bigger error, and it's going to be bigger by this amount. Of course it's bigger, but is it bigger enough that you get the right answer? Well, what is the SVD of D? If we fit it to rank 1, we get sigma UV transpose, so the Moore-Penrose inverse is sigma inverse VU transpose. Sigma 1 is the largest singular value of a normal matrix. And now we condition on D. And conditional on D, this is just a row vector of Gaussians. That's a column vector of Gaussians. So things get a little bit easier. And we just get the dimension times sigma to the minus 2. And then we need to get expected value of sigma to the minus 2. And we can get that from spiked covariance models. And if we sum that over all of the holdouts, the expected cross-validated error, if you knew it was 0, would be 1. And if you guessed 1, you'd get something bigger by this amount. Okay, so we actually, it's not our dream to know apart the rank 0 and the rank 1 case, but what this tells us, it gives us some intuition. For example, if r equals 1 and s equals 1, this term is kind of small. If we hold out more and make r and s bigger, this term gets bigger. This tells us that if we hold out a big block, it's going to be easier to get the rank 0 case right. If we hold out a small block, we're more likely to overfit. So one by one holdouts, you might end up with too big of a value k. Bigger holdouts, you're less likely to overestimate k. So we should hold out the whole matrix then. If you believe that, you should say let's hold out all but one element, or k elements or something. Obviously something has to be fighting you back the other way. It's not going to be optimal to hold out everything. And if the true rank is 1, and we fit a 0, that's easy. The hard case is if the true rank is 1 and we fit rank 1. And that's where we had to, if the true rank is 1 and we fit rank 1, if u is fixed and the other vector is random, then we can use spiked covariance. But we want, if we made that assumption, we can't sort of assume that u is fixed and v is Gaussian and also assume that v is fixed and u is Gaussian. That just wouldn't feel right. And so we needed to be able to treat them both. And if they're both Gaussian, then the matrix doesn't have IID rows or IID columns. And if they're both fixed, it's not IID. What you get is independent in one case, identically distributed in the other. So you get independent or identically distributed. That's not good enough. So we ended up building on Onotsky's case. Here, what you expect, it's Mn for your elements plus kappa squared for the signal. It makes sense that the signal should grow with sample size. In the strong factor model, kappa squared grows proportionally to Mn, so the signal is comparable to the noise. In the weak factors, the signal grows slower than the noise. It's like the square root of Mn. But this delta had better be bigger than 1. If delta is smaller than 1, it's like invisible factors. You could never even tell they were there. And so what we want to do is work with the strongest weak factors we can get. So our weak factors are like a really big delta times square root of Mn. Okay, so we chop up the matrix into pieces, fit rank 1. Here's our noise. We fit an SVD to this piece. That piece looks like this. And we rewrite the rank 1 part to be unit vectors. So these aren't unit vectors, but we can make them unit vectors by just changing kappa. And then we fit an SVD. We should actually get back something like this. This kappa, that U vector, that V vector. And so using Onatsky's theory, we actually do get more or less that that SVD coming back as the data set gets large. We need to assume that we didn't hold out the whole vector. So if that's like assuming that this thing really had, the signal here really had rank 1. So that's what these do. Okay, here's a summary. We take our loss and then subtract Mn. If it's really rank 0, then we're getting this if we fit rank 0, and a little bit more if we fit rank 1. This doesn't go off to infinity, so there'll still be a chance of getting the wrong rank. Actually, with regular cross-validation, you usually get all the predictors you want plus some small number of extras that you didn't want. And we expect that here, too. In the if it's really rank 1, this picking rank 1 comes out smaller than picking something that wasn't rank 1, at least if delta doesn't get too extreme, the eta. And the eta, what could make eta go wrong is if you held out all of the signal, then that thing would go wrong. Okay. So, well, let's try a simulation to see how it works. Okay, simulation, and I'm going to write the details of the simulation over here so that we don't lose track of them. So x is mu plus z m by n. And it equals the sum over I, sigma I, ui, bi transpose. X hat k is the sum, now I goes 1 to k, sigma I, ui, vi transpose. So there's our rank k truncated. And now our loss is x hat k minus mu squared Frobenius norm. Okay, so if we used rank k, this is how far away we are from the true mean that's sitting underneath all the data. That's our scorecard. I actually have a typo on a later slide where I put an x here instead of mu. But we would like to pick a rank k that gets us close to the true underlying mean. Okay, and what should that thing look like? Well, we had normal noise. The signal could be equal to the noise, that's quite large, 10% of the noise or 1% of the noise. The singular values, we could have a binary case where they're all the same. And they're all the same and equal, and then they're all zero after that. Or we could have a geometric decay, where there's the biggest singular value, then the next one's only half of that, and the one after that's only half of that. And the thing actually has rank infinity, except it's finite dimension. Okay, so here's a large simulation. The matrix had 50 singular values that were positive and equal, and 950 zeros. And it's a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix. And it's a pretty high signal. On this axis, we have the rank. And if you fit rank 0, you get an error of 1. A true error of 1, this loss quantity back here. So this is what an oracle could tell you what the loss was, because the oracle knows mu. And the loss goes down to rank 50, and then it comes back up after that. So the true rank is also the best rank. The naive loss comes down quickly to 50, and it keeps going down, because the fit keeps getting better. And the cross-validated loss drops like this to about 50, and then creeps up slowly after that. So on this case, the cross-validated loss actually gets the answer 50. This is actually 10 independent replications, all three of these. So with a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix, the results are pretty stable. You do it 10 times, and it's within pixels. It's the same pixel. Maybe if I did LWD equals 1 instead of 2, it would be different. But they overlap a lot. Okay, hold on. Where are you? Look like that. I divided everything by the value at the upper left just to make everybody start at 1 and come down proportionally to the value at 1. And then this is holding out 200 by 200 blocks, and this is using 500 by 500 holdouts. And this is using 800 by 800 holdouts. So now the advantage of holding out most of the data is that it gets really fast to do the SVD on a tiny part. Now, these big holdouts are really good at not overfitting, because this curve is steeper. And the smaller holdouts have a harder time of not overfitting. And likewise, there's the opposite thing going on over there. Here's the geometric case. So now there really isn't a true rank for mu. The mu has rank equal to its dimension. And the singular values just drop off geometrically. And here's the actual loss. And we can't really see that, so let's rescale it. We rescale it to 1, and we see that the true loss drops rapidly and takes its minimum at 3. I have a million numbers, and I'm not going to use more than rank 3 to be optimal. That was a bit surprising. And the cross-validated curves more or less take a minimum there, and of course the naive thing keeps going down. With the low signal case, which is actually below detection, rank 0 is the best. Even though the truth is rank 50, you can't find it. And these cross-validated curves can sort of tell that it should be rank 0. We looked at regret. Well, here's the error we got. There's what the oracle would have got. We can get a ratio. And we also compared to some BIC-style penalties. So you can add a penalty to a degree of freedom type penalty. These guys were trying to pick the correct K. We were agnostic as to whether there is a correct K. So we're just trying to pick a best K. Here are the regret ratios. I'll draw your attention to this one. 500 by 500 holdouts, if you hold out half the rows and half the columns, it got the best rank every time, 60 out of 60. On this side, it's the binary cases. This side, it's the geometric, high, medium, and low signal. If you held out small blocks, 200 by 200, you messed up a little bit on the medium signal binary. If you hold out 800 by 800, you mess up a little bit on the medium signal geometric. Okay, I have another example on a tiny matrix, but I'll skip that. because I want to show you the non-negative matrix factorization. Okay, so non-negative matrix factorization, you approximate by some skinny matrices with just k columns, non-negative entries. The reasoning is your data are non-negative in many applications, so why would you even tolerate predictions that could be negative? The killer example for this was a set of images that they had. So they took these, 16 by 16 pixel images, rolled them out into a vector, and then had a whole population of those, ran non-negative matrix factorization on it, and came back with lots and lots of zeros. And the pieces that came back were interpretable as parts. So you'd run across all these faces, and you'd pull out the coefficient. Instead of getting an eigenface, and after you've seen a few eigenfaces, they get really blurry because it's a linear combination of all the faces. These would pull out like mustaches and unibrows and eyebrows, and discrete parts of the image came out. It was an extremely tuned example, but it was very persuasive that there was some something going on. Okay, so, but in that case, you still have the problem of picking k. How many pieces should you put in? So, if we fit the non-negative matrix decomposition to the retained data, we can still take the generalized inverse and make a prediction. You don't always have a reverse order law for Moore-Penrose inverses, so you can't always write that. But in this case, you can. So this is a special case where you do have a reverse order law. So we can actually run a non-negative matrix factorization on that and cross-validate it. Okay. Just as a sidelight, your prediction ends up looking like this. A matrix on the left times a matrix on the right. Those might actually not be non-negative. As a matter of taste, you think maybe they should be non-negative. And so we have also a version where we constrain those factors to be non-negative. Let's look at this guy is a Moore-Penrose inverse times C. That's just a regression, a multivariate regression. So we replace the regression by a non-negative regression, and we argmin a different way, and we can get a non-negative side here and a non-negative side there. So you can make it respect the non-negativity if you like. Here's an example from information retrieval. There's a corpus of abstracts from three different journals, or three different sources. The abstracts were a few hundred words each. Some of them were medical, some of them aeronautical, some of them were information retrieval. And after running it through a Porter stemmer, there's just over 4,000 distinct word stems that come up, 3,000 odd abstracts, very, very sparse, about 1% of the values were non-zero. And then we just say, how many times does word I appear in document J? That would be our matrix. Okay, so that's the data. We fit a rank 1 NMF to each of the three sources. And then we smush them together into a rank 3 NMF for the whole data. And then we wanted to add noise. There's no fair generating it without noise and then finding it. So to get noise, we took WH and we added some Poisson noise to it. So we resampled, and we resampled so that the noise was equal to the total signal. And then we're hoping for a 3. Actually, we wouldn't be too bad with a 4 either, but we're hoping for a 3. But of course, the rank really is 4 because this, in the Poisson case, adding noise actually changes the rank. In the Gaussian case, it doesn't. Okay. Here is the true oracle loss. The oracle wants to do 3, even though the rank is 4. So if you fit rank 3, you're going to get the best reconstruction. And here are various of our cross-validated ones. This is naive. The criterion keeps going down. this one hits a min at 3, that one hits a min at 3. I might have the wrong colors, because I thought that leaving half by half, I thought the 2 by 2 holdouts hit 3. One of them had a min at 4, I think. And again, this is 10 repetitions superimposed. So one of the lessons is, with a big data set, maybe you don't have to do things 10 times. Maybe you don't have to do like a 25 times of a 5 by 5 cross-validation. Maybe just a few of them would work. Okay, some other outer product models. I alluded that you could take, you could put other constraints on. K-means has an interesting structure, and we've kind of started peeking at what happens to K-means if you tried to pick K this way. So the conclusion for cross-validation is we can actually make it work leaving out blocks. We don't think it's wrong to leave out a one by one. It's just it just would be harder to do. You'd have to start, some kind of EM thing to estimate. Okay, so I have some people to thank. Patrick Perry is a student working with me on this for his PhD. We're very grateful to Onatsky for sharing some of the very hard work that he did. And of course, I'm delighted with the Newton Institute for hosting and with the organizers. And also thank you for listening.
Questions?
Well, I've asked you this before, Art, but I think the answer is useful to hear, but
yes.
You don't seem to want to leave out sprinkle data.
Yeah.
Why not?
Okay, so with the sprinkled data, you could take your matrix and then randomly designate 10% of them to be the holdout. And I think that might be as good or slightly worse or slightly better. So it's and I think actually maybe I'll get to that later. But it's as a matter of taste. If I've left out a block, then I can run the SVD. Or I can run NMF. So I don't have to go make a special missing data SVD. I can just use stuff off the shelf.
You have the movie data, right, which is incomplete. It's already it's sprinkled in a random way. So
right.
The problem suggests that
I don't have like a strong feeling against doing that. Maybe in a year or two, that's what I'm going to be doing. But I couldn't think of any way to analyze what's going on either. So I'd like a little when I see. Like when Peter McCullough shows the bootstrap is broken in these problems, I think maybe we want to get a little theoretical support for what we're doing. And I think the theory is going to be easier on the block structure than on a sprinkle structure. I could be wrong. Maybe the sprinkle thing may actually end up being better. Yeah.
Questions?
A triple matrix, is there some kind of SVD type of decomposition exist?
Yeah, more than one. That's so for tensor methods, there are several. So I can give you, there's like this Parafac model and the Tucker model, and then there's like at least three or four ways to define the rank of a three-dimensional tensor. They don't agree. Computing them is NP-hard, and there are weird things, like there is no closest rank 3 matrix to your given, a rank 3 tensor to your given tensor. So it's a completely different game once you get above 2.
Yeah. Any more questions? Let's thank Art again.